The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
She was wonderful. She was the best type of person that you could want somebody to be a friend. She was a lot of different things. She was very artistic. I remember I was just drawn to her. Allie didn't care about what other people thought. Allie wore what she wanted to wear. She did her hair how she wanted to wear it and wore her makeup how she wanted to. And I was drawn to that. And we would sit in class and she would show me all of her drawings and poems that she would do, and at the time, so I was trying to find a way to express myself, and Allie just personified that. Like, she had already had it down. Like, she knew how she wanted to be, she knew what she wanted to do, and I admired that so much about her. But she was also a sweetheart, so if you wanted to talk to her and you're having a bad day, she would come up and she would talk to you. Like, there was, during that year, I was dating a not-so-great guy, and I confided in her a lot that year. You know, Allie was just a good friend. She was always there for people. She was always there to love them, but to also have a good time with. And so I miss that a lot. I miss having that type of person in my life. And I have that now, but Allie was just different. She was just an all-around good person to have.
Little is known about Allie Lowitzer's movements after she was last seen exiting her school bus just a few houses down from her home at 2:45 p.m. on Monday, April 26th, 2010. Two neighborhood boys saw Allie begin walking in the opposite direction of her residence upon stepping off the bus. It is likely from a phone conversation with her mother, Joanne, just prior to boarding the bus at Spring High, that she intended to walk to her place of employment to pick up her paycheck and attempt to pick up a shift. Somewhere along the way, at 2:57 p.m., Allie sent a text message to a friend asking if they'd come hang out with her at the Lowitzer home later that day. This text is the last activity from Allie's cell phone. Joanne texted Allie to check on her shortly after returning home from work that evening at about 7 p.m. When she received no response, Joanne assumed Allie was able to pick up a shift at the Burger Barn and was too busy to return the text right away, or simply didn't want to get into any trouble at work for using her phone on the clock. Joanne began to grow concerned, however, having not received a response from her for some time, as Allie, like most in the age of cell phones, teenager or adult, would always find some way to reply. After sending out a few more texts that lacked response, Joanne started calling Allie's phone. There was no answer. She drove to the Burger Barn just after 9 p.m., when Allie would typically be finished with her shifts, but the restaurant was devoid of activity. The chairs were on the tables, the lights out, and no one was there. Allie was gone. The night was a whirlwind for the Lowitzer household, as they attempted to locate Allie by calling friends, parents of friends, and anywhere they could think of that Allie frequented. The police were called, and even at the insistence of Joanne and Allie's father, John, that she would not have run away, they considered Allie to have left on her own volition. Of course, Allie's parents knew their child.
She was a teenage 16-year-old girl. She liked to wear dark eye makeup and, you know, black clothes and fix her hair, you know, different styles all the time. You know, yeah, she ran away. And this complete stranger doesn't know your child. You know, if If I would have thought that she had ran away, I would be the first person to say so.
All of Allie's close friends later agreed that she would have never left home, particularly without her personal items, such as her cash and cell phone's charging cord. Sensing law enforcement would be little immediate help, Allie's parents called the Laura Recovery Center, an organization formed to aid the families in the search for missing loved ones, the next day, on April 27, 2010. Laura Recovery's Dawn Davis was assigned to help the Lowitzers, and it didn't take her long to rule out the theory that the police had held.
When we were contacted by Joanne, I remember that myself and one of our team members went to Joanne's house, and we talked to her, and we did intakes on the case. And when we would do the intake on the cases, we would look for red flags. We would look for things that gave us an indication of where we could possibly search, whether a search was needed or warranted, because each missing person incident takes on a different look. You know, there might be some that the search entails the flyer distribution. There may be some where it's a phone call to different people within that case. It may be something where you do a ground search with volunteers. So we analyze all of those things that we learn in that case intake, and then we go on to determine a plan of action. And as we talked to Joanne, it was very apparent to us that she felt very confident that Allie would not just leave. There was many indications that there was very little reason to believe that she had left on her own. And because of that, we decided that we would do a ground search and flyer distribution working hand in hand, as well as talking with friends and law enforcement to see if they had any information that might help us find a direction to look for Allie. When we came up with our plan of action, we decided that a ground search would be appropriate. You know, every day thousands of kids go missing, but there's just a very small percentage of them that are actually abducted by a stranger or taken from home. But, you know, every day when kids go missing, there's thousands of kids that go missing, and they fit into certain different categories. They either are missing because they're a runaway, or they've lost contact with their caretaker. They've been lost from their caretaker. There's family abduction. And then just a very small percentage of those are a stranger abduction, where the children are harmed or taken away for a long period of time. Unfortunately, when people look at those numbers, kids like Allie kind of fall in the cracks because of her age, or because of, you know, certain circumstances like school or family dynamics or those types of things. They might be considered a runaway. Well, I feel like now, all these years later, that you can feel and say that the chances of Allie being a runaway are very minimal. You know, there were a lot of things to me that stuck out. She didn't take her purse. She didn't take any money. There was no activity after a certain point on her cell phone. And anybody that has a teen can probably acknowledge that no activity on a teen cell phone is very highly unusual. And if you had cash, you would take that cash with you if you intended to leave. So things like that were definitely red flags that said that if she left on her own, that she didn't intend to stay gone. Another reason that we felt strongly about Allie is that we felt like, based on everything we had learned and talked about with people who knew Allie, with people who knew the family, that Joanne and Allie had a good relationship. There wasn't a reason for her to leave. Maybe she had some of those teen problems that others have experienced. It wasn't a situation where she would want to leave home. We started out searching on a daily basis, and then when nothing was found, we increased the search area and went to weekends. After that, we went to as needed, or if information came in that we felt that a certain area needed to be looked at, then we would arrange to go out there again. And so it was quite a while, because I even saw that there were searches into 2011 when I was reviewing my notes. We were involved for quite a while. In many long-term missing cases, you receive information from people with concerns about sex offenders that live in the area. And you also receive information. I've been out of the case management for a couple of years now, but from what I understand, it's been more and more prevalent that teens are approached by their peers more often now than in the past in trying to entice them into a human trafficking type scenario where another teen is taking them and inviting them to a hotel where they're approached by someone else. And so we see where human trafficking is taking a big jump too in our children's lives.
The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime defines human trafficking as the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons by means of the threat or use of coercion, abduction, fraud, or deception for the purpose of exploitation. Exploitation shall include the exploitation of the prostitution of others or other forms of sexual exploitation. Houston, Texas, the city in which Spring serves as a suburb outlier, is one of the largest hubs for human trafficking in the United States, and the largest in Texas. The city is home to a revolving door of brothels, consisting of 200 at any given time, an average of 2 opening every month. Houston's seemingly endless status as a 365-day-a-year host to business conventions, as well as many major sporting events, attract visitors from not only around the nation on a regular basis, but also from around the world. This is undoubtedly a factor that stimulates the growth of the sex industry in the city, which, by proxy, also provides Houston with a bountiful customer base for human traffickers. The city's economy is booming and is an incubator for the labor market, making it difficult for law enforcement to keep up with the tangled web that human trafficking has become there. 2 very large international airports and the proximity to Latin America also contribute to the prevalence of human trafficking in Houston. A study released in January of this year by the University of Texas suggests that there may be up to 79,000 youths or minors that are victims of sexual exploitation through trafficking, though this hidden population, the study says, is historically difficult to reach. In 2013, Joanne Lowitzer's private investigator traveled to Ohio to seek out a potential lead in Allie's case not long after she came on board.
We actually started going to Ohio not long afterwards. I had found some information. We had a lot of tips come in from one area. And I said, you know, there's just, I got a gut feeling. This is what I had. I presented it to her and I said, you know, I want you to make the decision whether we need to go or not. I felt we needed to go. When you get a very publicized case, you know, you get sightings all over the world and you have to learn to sort through them. So you can't just get up and get on a plane and go across the country because you don't have the money, you know, on every single one. But I had indirect evidence, basically. Ohio PD, they've had several undercover officers that had seen a female that resembled Allie, like that they believed that it was Allie. Like I said, these were several deputies. Some of them took a personal interest in Allie's case. They just felt in their hearts that that girl up there, which we call Columbus Alley, that she was our, you know, our Alley. And, you know, but we worked hard to, you know, get in and try to figure out where she was there. And there's a lot of people on the street that had seen her too. Once I got up there and started showing her photo, a lot of people had seen her. And actually, it was a girl named Alley, but we never actually tracked down that girl. So, but Columbus PD is ready to act, the Missing Persons Department, the NCIC system. So, you know, it's a national database. It's federal law that a child is entered into the NCIC system within 2 hours of them being missing, actually any missing person. Well, in 2013, we were going in for a raid, and, you know, we had worked, you know, to raid these houses that this girl that everybody had seen. This girl was tied up in the same human trafficking ring. So if, when they busted the houses, our hopes were we would find her in one of them and be able to see, is she Allie or not? Well, when the Columbus, Ohio Police Department, they go to look in the day of the raid to pull her NCIC file, like, or there's something, some orders that are attached to the NCIC file. She was not in the database. They had no hold orders on her. Mind you, they had her finger, Allie's fingerprints and everything. And she was supposed to be in the system, and her fingerprints were supposed to flag if she would have ever been arrested or, you know, anything. She wasn't in the system. That was in 2013. I mean, we threw a fit to get her in there, but, and they did that day, you know, after hanging up on a Columbus, Ohio Police Department. And so anyways, even the captain, it was one of the detectives, the captain, and, you know, taking a go at it. And then it was wasn't until one of the FBI agents, because FBI and Homeland were also involved in this raid, they're the ones that called them. Because the person that enters the file, it has to come from the agency that holds the case, which was Harris County. They could not enter it for them.
The Laura Recovery Center's Dawn Davis has seen virtually every aspect of cause and outcome of missing children's cases, including those with twists and turns. Though it is essentially certain that Allie did not vanish of her own free will, if she had, victimization lurks closely in nearly any scenario, and some cases have caused law enforcement to rethink labeling a missing teenager a runaway with such reckless abandon.
There's lots of circumstances, too, where a child can leave home as a runaway, and within 48 hours, they say that they've been at least approached by individuals who don't have their best interests at heart. We have issues here in Houston with human trafficking. We have issues where those children are victimized as soon as they hit the streets. So even being a runaway does not mean that a child is safe. And I can remember one case, and I'm not going to say the law enforcement organization that it was with, but I remember one case where two young ladies left on their own accord. And they had been trafficked, and one of them actually got free and came home. At that point, all those years ago, people weren't talking about human trafficking. And so hearing that the girls left on their own, they were put down as runaways. Well, they had runaways, but within 24 hours of them running away, they had been victimized by being trafficked to another state. And one of them getting free to call home and to get home. They left together. They were victimized within 24 hours. They returned back. But law enforcement was hesitant to label it as human trafficking because those girls had left on their own. So instead of labeling it human trafficking, they were labeled as runaways. You know, those girls, they were the victims. Just because they run away does not mean that it's okay for somebody to victimize them or to hurt them or abuse them. But I think that we have, you know, we've taken some strides. We've taken some steps. Law enforcement is getting the training and the knowledge that they need.
It is unlikely that we can protect our children from facing potential or even immediate harm completely and absolutely. But there are steps that can be taken to lessen the chances of them falling victim to depraved individuals.
We have to find a really good medium where we're acting on these missing children because they deserve better. They deserve the best shot that we can give them. Like I say, nowadays it's even more difficult with all our technology, but I think communication is important with our children, as well as being vigilant as parents. You know, you have to know what they're doing online. You have to have some rules there. It's important to keep, you know, that communication open and going. I try really hard to not talk badly or bash law enforcement because they have a job to do that is not always easy. But I think that as a community and as a public, we need to also err on the side of caution with our children. A lot of times you'll hear people talk about a 24-hour rule that they can't report a child as missing unless they've been gone 24 hours. Well, that's a myth. If your child is missing, you don't wait. You call 911. You contact those people that can help you. One of the people that I used to work with used to say, you pray for the sprint, but you plan for the marathon. Meaning that we pray that that child comes home as quick as possible, but that we need to prepare for the marathon so we're not a step behind. And I think that that's kind of what we have to ingrain in law enforcement is that, you know, let's pray for the sprint, but let's prepare for the marathon. Chances are that child will come home, but make sure we take all those actions necessary that we're not running behind where we should be. And I think that Joanne has been extremely active and has been so driven to find Allie. She has taken every opportunity, every means that you can do to try to help build awareness and to put your child's picture out in front of the public so that if somebody does see something, that they say something and that they record it. She's done awareness events. She's done events that have brought other missing children out into the forefront. She's interacted with other parents of missing children. She's searched for other missing children. She's done events where she has distributed flyers and done private investigators and billboards and everything that you can possibly imagine. She has worked harder than, you know, I think many of the families I've worked with. She has worked so hard in trying to find Allie and to try to find those answers.
And, you know, I didn't know any better, you know, that first night that she went missing. Did you know that there is no law that you have to wait 24 hours to report a missing person? And I didn't know that back then, you know, because that's what you've always heard. Oh, well, wait 24 hours before you call the police. And anytime any other parent or family reaches out to me, you know, oh, my daughter didn't come home yesterday. You know, I called and, you know, the police told me to wait until tomorrow. I said, no, you do not have to wait tomorrow. You call them back and demand that they make a report. You know, because there's just so much. Or if the law enforcement officers that take these phone calls, if they would just tell the parents, you know, look, you can call NCMEC or you can call Texas EquiSearch, you know, you can call, you know, all these different organizations and they can help you tonight. We're not going to do anything until tomorrow. You know, and that's how, you know, I told you earlier that I felt lost. I felt lost and alone, you know, for that first 24 hours because I had no idea what the hell to do. No idea. And, you know, I've been struggling to try to put some of this down in writing so I could write a book. I plan on making it very well known, you know, exactly what you need to do, you know, if your child does go missing. You know, and I put that on Allie's, you know, Facebook page. I haven't lately, but, you know, I try to tell parents, you know, you don't have to wait 24 hours. You know, you need to do this and you need to go out and look for your own child, basically. Report them missing and get your butt out there and go look, you know, because there's a lot of parents out there that, you know, maybe they do think that their child ran away, but they didn't go look for them. And I never understood that part. You know, I know every family is different. You know, not everybody is raised the same, but, you know your family, you know your kids, and especially a mom knows when something's wrong. Hopefully you would go crazy on them. Any parent that knows that is not a law, that is just a rule of thumb, you know, should definitely go apeshit on any law enforcement officer that tells them to wait.
If you have any information about the disappearance of Alexandria Joy Lowitzer, please contact the Harris County Sheriff's Department at 713-967-5810.
I really think that there is someone out there that knows what happened to Allie. They have information that they either feel like is not important enough or that they feel like they can't tell. But I would encourage them to rethink that, to make a call. It takes one phone call from someone who recognizes a picture or who has a vital part of the puzzle to help find that child and bring them home. And I think that there's somebody out there that has that vital piece of information that knows what happened to Allie. And they can, just by making that one phone call, they can bring some answers to the Wolitzers. They can do it anonymously. They can call Crime Stoppers. They can call their local law enforcement. I think even making a phone call to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. There's so many different vehicles to get your information to the right people. When Allie went missing, the National Center was playing their role in trying to help locate her. There's been a lot of organizations out there, from a nonprofit to people who've been looking online for any indication of Allie, to National Center, to law enforcement, her family. Everybody has been trying, but there's one piece that's missing, and that's that person who has the information, that person that knows where Allie is. You really have to pray and hope for those people that really know something, that have some piece of information, whether it was something they saw that day that was unusual, whether it was in the days after, something out of the ordinary, something, whether it was a car that was not typically in the neighborhood, whether it was a person that was acting out of the ordinary, any of those things. It might not mean anything to you, but when looking at this puzzle of where is Allie, it might be that one puzzle piece that you put in that connects everything. I just really encourage people to think back to that day. Did they see something out of the ordinary in her neighborhood? Did they see someone who was out of the ordinary? Was there somebody who had been around and then all of a sudden was gone? It's important that each one of us stops and thinks about those questions. If you just rely on everyone else to think about it, then there's a possibility, again, that that information is lost. So I think all of their neighbors, all of the people at school, even law enforcement, I think, needs to go back and say, have we talked to her teachers? Have we talked to the school bus driver? Have we talked to her friends and those people who were on the bus that day? Just do an overview of that entire case and say, okay, where'd that crack where somebody put a phone through? Let's go back. Let's review that information. Let's talk to people again. It's still important. We watch CSI on TV and we see how law enforcement solves these cases. Well, a majority of cases are solved by individuals who come forward with information or report what they saw. For instance, in the case of Elizabeth Smart out of Utah, she was found because a person recognized her eyes that she had seen on those posters week after week. I mean, it is. It's the public that solves these crimes and these cases. All it takes is, like I said, is just one person. If the person that saw Elizabeth hadn't called, chances are they'd still be looking for her.
Please visit AlexandriaLowitzer.com to learn more about Allie and donate to the efforts to find her. And head over to Facebook and look for Hope for Allie, Alexandria Joy Lowitzer, to keep up to date on the events and explore Allie's life through photos and memories from Joanne. Please help Joanne get the word out by sharing Allie's flyers on the Facebook page. Also, please consider contributing to the fund to get Allie on the National Missing Persons Day, which will greatly increase awareness for her cause. You can donate at GoFundMe.com/national-missing-persons-day. You'll also find the link on the Hope for Allie Facebook page, as well as the Gone Cold Podcast Facebook page. We'd like to say thank you to Savannah Motia, Amber Kamak, and Don Davis for their contributions to this episode. And, of course, a huge thank you to Joanne Lowitzer for her help and support. If you would like to support the show, You can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Allie's story with friends, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases we cover and others. We also post pictures, so please join in. If true crime is your thing, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you can read about many cases. It's always well presented, respectful, and always fantastic. thetruecrimefiles.com is the best. And finally, we present a promo from our friend and fellow true crime podcaster, Erica. The podcast is called Southern Fried True Crime, and we love it. Erica is passionate about the cases she covers, and we can't get enough of her Southern drawl. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, host of the podcast Southern Fried True Crime. Each week, I take a look at a different Southern crime. Unlike any good gossip, I'm interested in anyone or anything. I cover contemporary and historical cases, and I love listener suggestions. Come join me as I explore the dark underbelly of the Deep South. I'm a one-woman show in a narrative format, kind of like sitting by the fire and listening to a story. So pull up a chair and subscribe if you're interested. I'd love to have you. Until then, y'all take care.